Several times in the Exodus account, God tells Pharaoh why he is focusing his overwhelming power against Pharaoh. And when you read through that and you recognize that God says things like he's hardening Pharaoh's heart and so on, he has to win over Pharaoh, and the fact that Pharaoh was deified as a god and represented kind of all the other gods of Egypt, that God was not just freeing ancient Israel in that process, he was making a statement. And he told Pharaoh this a couple of times, maybe probably more than two, but in Exodus 9, verse 29, also Exodus 19 and verse 5, he made the statement that he was doing this, that you may know that the earth is mine. He said that to Pharaoh, that you may know that the earth is mine. That was a statement he was making in all that he was doing in freeing ancient Israel. He, God, owns the earth and everything in it, and everything that is made from it. He expects this to inspire honor and obedience toward him and those who understand and get this, but quite often it's missing. It's not prevalent in Christianity, professing Christianity today, and it's completely lost in academia, in business, in government, most other religions in the world as well. This respect for God, that he owns everything. In Deuteronomy 10, I'll just give you four verses here where he says this. Deuteronomy 10 and verse 14, he says, "Indeed, heaven and the highest heavens belong to the Lord your God. Also the earth with all that is in it." Everything belongs to him. Everything. The clothes on your back, the earrings hanging from your ears, the shoes on your feet, the tie around your neck. He owns everything. The car you will drive back to your house with tonight, your house itself, all the food in your fridge, every dollar in your bank account, everything belongs to him. In Job 41, in verse 11, this is after Job goes through that horrendous experience of learning about his own self-righteousness, as God is speaking to him towards the end, he told Job, quote, "Everything under heaven is mine," unquote. In Haggai chapter 2 and verse 8, Haggai 2 verse 8 says, "The basis of what we call wealth," this is what it was talking about, silver and gold. He says that the silver and gold belong to him. Almost every monetary unit on this planet is based on some form of wealth like that, silver, gold, platinum, something, some reserve that backs up the value of a dollar or a yen or something. Otherwise, they just call it fiat currency, which everything is kind of becoming at this point. But right now, if it is backed up, if it's what's called hard currency, it's usually silver and gold that backs it up. Well, all that belongs to God, all of it. In Psalm 24 and verse 1, Psalm 24, 1, God inspired David to write, quote, "The earth is the Lord's and all its fullness, the world and those who dwell therein," unquote. God owns every one of us and everything about us. It's easy for humans to overlook this. So quite often God reminds us of this. That's only four verses. Let's look at Deuteronomy chapter 8 here. Deuteronomy chapter 8, and we'll see how this happens. Largely it happens when we have successes in this life, when we start gathering wealth, when we have houses and move into them, or we start buying cars or whatever else, and we start owning things, they seem like they are ours, especially when we work hard for them. In verses 11 through 18 here, he warns Israel this. Again, Deuteronomy 8, verse 11. "Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and his statutes, which I command you today, lest when you have eaten and are full and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness in which were fiery serpents and scorpions, a thirsty land in which was no water, who brought water for you out of the flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do you good in the end. Then you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth. And you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he swore to your fathers, as it is to this day. This is what happens. Wealth kind of leads us to this. Bizarrely as it may seem, our wealth and our dependency on our wealth lead us to enslavement. I mean, what happened to ancient Israel after being blessed by God in many, many ways, falling then into a enslavement mentality within Egypt for many, many years. And one generation after the other learned that. And it's still, I think, to a great degree, if you look at the descendants of ancient Israel to this day, that slave mentality is still there. A lot of it has to do with being enslaved to physical things on this earth and thinking that we have to do things to preserve them, to keep them, when all it takes really is visiting somebody on their deathbed, especially somebody who's incredibly wealthy. You visit them on their deathbed, none of their wealth means anything to them at that point. How can it? With their last breath or their last pump of blood through their veins, everything they accomplished in this age is gone. And they're starting to wonder, what was that all about? I think it was Barbara Bush that said that, told Wellesley College back in the 90s when she's giving the commencement address, that they will not think of when they're on their deathbed of the case they didn't win, if they're an attorney, or something in their business or career they didn't do, or something they didn't buy. They will be thinking about their relationships that they did not develop. They will have regrets over not having a closer contact with family, with friends, and so on, especially their relationship with their children. And that's, everyone goes through that. If you do visit individuals in situations like that, you'll see that. Our wages in this age, the profits that we make while we are here, our income, all of that belongs to God. He rightfully owns all we make and all the energy and effort we use to make it, whatever we expend. But God is in no way selfish. Every loving father wants to share what he has with his children. But every loving father also knows that proper ownership requires their involvement. Your child will appreciate something much more if they worked for it than if you simply handed it to them. If at age 16 you whipped a brand new car on them to drive back and forth to high school and then to college and so on, every kid will go, yeah, this is great, that's exactly how I want. A father will know the car doesn't mean anywhere near as much as the character of his child. And usually we'll have that child work and contribute at least something to the car so that they understand the value of that car. That's a greater lesson that they will take with them long after that car is no longer even functioning. Their contribution adds to the wealth of their inheritance and teaches them to respect it. For this reason, God has granted humanity dominion over the earth. By no means does it take it from God. It's a responsibility to have dominion over the earth. It's not about possession. Look at Genesis chapter 1 here. Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 through 30. This is something we need to remind ourselves of often because the world doesn't see this anymore, especially as we move more into this environmental influence that's going on, the pressure of global warming or climate change or whatever they're calling it today. This is a means of trying to control and redistribute wealth. We need to see that for what it is and understand that a lot of it is not based upon clear science, even though they say it is. We can't just assume that. Here's the one thing we have to keep in mind. Genesis 1, verses 26 through 30. Then God said, let us make man in our image. This is the Logos, and the one that became the Logos' father at some point when Christ was born. Let us make man in our image according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image, and in the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. Then God blessed them, male and female, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion, again, over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. This is not the prevailing mindset today, that men are supposed to have dominion, be responsible. They want them to be responsible for the earth, but to the point of men serving the earth, as opposed to the earth serving God's purpose for humanity. There's a difference between stewardship, which is what God gave humanity, and ownership. God retains possession of everything that he has made for this reason. Everything seen and unseen. Evolutionists reject this, but they're losing the argument between random chance and intelligent design. I think we've had that discussion here a number of times. Right now, this is all it comes down to. You have two choices for the existence of all things, the origins. Number one, random chance. All this just kind of happened on its own. No design here, no one directing or ordering or structuring this. Everything there is random chance. The scientists are starting to realize that's ridiculous. They estimate the probability of life beginning itself. The probability of that is like 1 in 10 to the 118th power. In probability, 1 in 10 to the 50th power is null. You know what null is in probability? It means it's impossible. If the actual probability of life beginning itself is 1 in 10 to the 118th power, that's like twice null. It's impossible for that to happen. Scientists are starting to recognize that in the argument of probability, they can't win that. So what are they doing? Accepting the eternal God? Accepting the biblical account of how all this came into being? No. They're going in the other direction. They realize the logic in the case for a creator. But the godless arrogant, through woke environmentalism, are doubling down with an old pagan concept that the earth itself is a sentient God being. The earth itself is sentient. It thinks, it reasons, it designs, it brought about all of this. In fact, that they don't want to call it anymore. They refer to it as her, a female deity. They're attempting to compel all humans to subjugate themselves to her, Mother Earth, Mother Nature. In ancient mythology, this woman was known as Gaia, G-A-I-A. And you may not hear that, but if you understand and research what Gaia is, you'll recognize it as a pagan concept that calls the earth sentient. And it's the earth that makes a determination of what happens, what species live, what species do not, that the earth has worked through evolution to bring everything to this point with intelligent design. That's very dangerous. I'd like to read this from Gaia.com, G-A-I-A.com, their own website. And this is all a quote. Quite simply, Gaia is life. She is all, the very soul of the earth. She is a goddess who, by all accounts, inhabits the planet, offering life and nourishment to all her children. In the ancient civilization, she was revered as mother, nurturer, and giver of life. In 1970, chemist James Lovelock and his research partner Lynn Margulis, just a side quote here, Lynn Margulis at the time was the wife of Carl Sagan. Do you remember Carl Sagan of Cosmos fame? Wife of Carl Sagan. Back to the quote now. Lynn Margulis proposed that the earth is a living being, self-regulating the elements to sustain life on it. This revolutionary hypothesis was seen as heretical, but has since been accepted as fact, a theory no longer, rather a hypothesis, unquote. This concept now is embedded even within our language. And you'll notice this, when a popular movement wants to change the culture, you'll hear it first in the language. That's why you can't say, I'm gay today, and people think you're happy. Right? I've heard now that the popular term for a felon, because that's offensive, is a justice-involved person. You'll hear this kind of stuff more and more. Have you heard the word sustainability within these kinds of discussions? If I use a word, I want you, we'll do a little game here that they do in psychology. I'll say a word, what's the first word that comes to your mind? Dysfunctional. Did anybody hear the word family come to mind? You only hear the term dysfunctional used with respect to family. And that's embedded within that, our language for a good 2 to 3 decades or more. So we all think of that. Dysfunctional, you immediately think family. That's not by accident. That doesn't just happen. That's actually being controlled. And you'll hear some of these Gaia elements and this language embedded itself in discussions of creation versus evolution or any of the supposed scientific information about this. Back to the quote now. Quote, their work, this is the work of Lovelock and Margulis, quote, their work suggested that the Earth chemicals all talk to one another to protect life on the planet. All elements work in perfect harmony to ensure life on Earth is sustained. The stability of life and its consistent ability to self-regulate and protect Earth's creatures connotes a universe much more intelligent than previously imagined. Gaia theory taught that a sophisticatedly aware universe is regulating these many facets to protect and preserve life on the planet. Far beyond the mythological Gaia, the name has come to represent an all-loving, nurturing, and intelligent cosmic force which oversees life on Earth. The goddess traditions have worked tirelessly to resurrect the ancient teachings of the Great Mother and ensure her presence as a force of love on the planet. More than saving the planet or participating in Earth Day celebrations, we can treat every day like a ceremony. To be in a sincere, connected relationship with Gaia, we must acknowledge her sundry gifts and be open to receive her wisdom. Unquote. Leaders in this group and others who follow them are working to convince humanity that we are a ward of the planet versus the reverse. God's intent here is quite opposite, as we see from Scripture. But I read this because I want to warn you, be careful what environmental groups you support. Where is that money going? Who's using it? And what are their basic philosophies? If it's anything against what God says in His Word, we should not be involved with it. God's people will know that He gave humanity stewardship over the earth so that we can fulfill His purpose for the earth itself and for man being on it. To prosper with that blessing, to add to the earth's beauty and value is what we're supposed to do. But our work with His creation is conditional, requiring that we honor Him and His will first. That's not just a matter of acknowledging that in the Scriptures and believing that. There is an action that shows God that we are involved in His work, that we participate in His plan for mankind. This is the reason we tithe. This is why we tithe. Why are those who tithe blessed beyond measure and those who don't suffer? Why do those who believe in the Creator understand how important tithing is? That tithing is an acknowledgement of God's dominion and is a faithful authentication or a confirmation of our desire to be involved in God's purpose. His offspring mean more to Him than does this planet. And He wants them to tithe, to be involved in His work, to acknowledge His dominion. And that then sets everything they do in their life in the right order. Today, I'd like to address in this context God's universal law of tithing. I usually like to cover this prior to the beginning of the Holy Day season. We'll talk about second tithe at the close of all this. I want to talk about the principle of tithing first, using first tithe and how important that is. I'll touch at the end on second tithe and third tithe and why they're so important, but as well how we actually apply them in this day and age. But I like to do this prior to the Holy Day process so people can start anticipating the use of their second tithe and the keeping of those holy days, because that second tithe is enabling us to celebrate with God and his people on those specific days that outlie his holy day plan for all of humanity. So let's go through that. Let's look at God's universal law here of tithing. The first time that tithing is used in Scripture is in Genesis 14. Let's go back and look at that. It's important on a number of levels. This is the time when the kings of the east, Chedorlaomer, king of Shinar, which could potentially be here, Nimrod, depending on the timing, came and took Sodom and Gomorrah and their captives and took them away. And then we see Abraham's response to that in the following verses. So we're in chapter 14 of Genesis. Up to verse 12, they also took Lot, Abraham's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom and his goods, and departed. We see then in verses 13 on that Abraham armed his servants, and he went after them. That's in verse 14. He divided his forces against them by night in verse 15, and they attacked and pursued them, and so on. And then when he returned, after a successful campaign of being able to capture back what belonged to Sodom and Gomorrah, the residents there themselves, and especially Lot and his family, that we read this in verse 17. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him, Abraham, at the valley of Sheva, that is King's Valley, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with them. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, or king of peace, brought out bread and wine. He was the priest of God Most High. That description of him is expanded on in the book of Hebrews. We'll touch on that later. And a recognition that this is the Logos. This is the God being, one of two within the Godhead, as we read in Genesis 1. That this was the God being who became Jesus the Christ. And that this ministry that Melchizedek had back then now extends to the ministry of Jesus Christ. And we'll read that again in Hebrews and other places in the New Testament shortly. Verse 19. And he, Melchizedek, blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abraham of God, Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God, Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And he, Abraham, gave him, Melchizedek, a tithe of all. This is the first time the word tithe is used in Scripture. It's translated from the Hebrew word ma'aser, M-A-A-S-E-R, and it means a tenth, or to pay a tenth, or to take a tenth. That's a very significant act on the part of Abraham. In presenting the tenth of all the spoils of victory to Melchizedek, he validates the exclusive godly authority of Melchizedek's priesthood. It's very important, and again, that'll be touched on in the book of Hebrews. But he as well shows us the way to do this, the way to acknowledge the authority of God over us and all things, and the authority of God's priesthood, giving him a tenth of his increase. The second time we see this word used, ma'aser, and translated tithe, is in Genesis 28. Let's turn there. Genesis 28, verses 18 through 22. This is describing Jacob's response to the dream that God gave him while he had his head on the stone there at the place where the temple would eventually be built, which is why he calls it here the house of God, changes it from Luz to the term house of God. Let's begin reading in verse 18, and we'll read through verse 22. Then Jacob rose early in the morning and took the stone that he had put at his head, set it up as a pillar, and poured oil on top of it. And he called the name of that place Bethel, which means house of God. But the name of the city had been Luz previously. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, "If God will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going, and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on." We remember he was on his way to go to Laban's family, where he would work, eventually get his two brides and their maids and his family from there and come back. But this is his parents wanted to make sure that he would not marry, as his brother Esau did, outside of the faith. And that's why he was being sent back here. Verse 21. This is the second part of that vow. So that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And this stone which I have set as a pillar shall be God's house, and all that you give me, you is capitalized because he's making that statement to God, I will surely give a tenth to you, a tithe to you, honoring God, not just in thanks for what God was doing with him, but in recognition that God was working with Jacob and that would work to establish Israel through Jacob. Jacob understood this, and he used the tithe to symbolize that. He understood that God would prosper him, but only under our submission to his will. He recognized he needed to submit to God's will and God's plan for that to happen. Look at Leviticus 27 now. I wanted to read those two verses because some people believe tithing came into practice at Sinai with Israel. No, it has a extended history prior to that, as do all the commandments, especially the Sabbath and holy days and so on. But here in Leviticus 27, we have the reference and the command to tithe, that the first tenth belongs to God. This is Leviticus 27. We'll read verses 30 through 32. It's making reference here to redeeming the tithe. I wanted to explain this. If you look at previous references in the book of chapter 27, the book of Leviticus, it's talking about buying back something, redeeming something. This is in no way making reference to borrowing from your tithe. So if you're setting aside second tithe, or you have to do that with respect to your first tithe, even to, like, for instance, if you have your own business or if you're in agriculture, use your tithe as paid after the harvest or after you reap a profit on your business. And sometimes that doesn't happen every week or every other week, like those of us who get a paycheck on a regular basis, so that you have to kind of hold that aside and then make a payment, usually by the end of the year, but quite often for people in the church, it's usually prior to the Feast of Tabernacles. In either case, you cannot borrow from that. This is not giving permission for that. When you redeem the tithe, in order for you to tithe, to pay the tithe, it goes to the priesthood. Now, once it goes to the priesthood, you can buy it back. The priesthood doesn't use all the tithes that they are given. Sometimes it's just too much. But they can sell some of that tithe, some of what they're given in terms of grain or animals or whatever, to have money to spend that on other things. And you now can go buy back what you gave them as tithe, but it's after it's already been given. It's not while it's in your hand. You haven't paid it yet, so there's no way to actually redeem it until it's actually transferred to the priesthood. Now, you can buy it back and use some of what you sold them, grain, animals, or whatever, but there's a condition on that. God says, add a fifth to it. He wants to make sure that the priesthood is not just a money laundering kind of scheme, or, you know, working through them to get something back. Adding the fifth to that would prevent that, and that's what he's talking about here. But this, again, is where tithing is mentioned, verse 30. And all the tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or of the fruit of the tree, again, it's a very agrarian society, is the Lord's. Notice that. All of the tithe, the tenth of the land, that first tenth of seed or land, fruit of the tree, is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord. I don't know if you've ever thought of that, but when you send your check in to the church as your tithe, or when you spend your second tithe or use your third tithe to help somebody who's indigent, what you're handling is holy. It's holy, as are the offerings that we give God. I remember once at the Feast of Tabernacles in the Dells, I was giving the sermon, but it was right after the offertory, and I was up on stage because it's a long walk at the Crystal Grand to get up to speak. So I got up there, so I was close to the lectern, and as I was there, I watched those who had just collected the tithe, faithful men led by the counter, the one who was going to oversee the counting of the offering. They were walking upstairs to the green room. I don't know if you remember the Dells backstage. There was really only one breakout room, and it was the green room. It's called the green room not because it's green, but because that's where everyone who goes on stage sits waiting to go on stage. And usually before you go on stage in a performance, you turn green. That's why it's called the Green Room. Anyway, I stood there watching them as they were coming in. And it was moving to consider that they were holding God's holy tithe and going through this process of these gifts that God considered precious in representing the involvement and the honor and the holy action of giving this tithe to God on the part of his children now is in their hands. And they were treating it like it was holy, because it was. I think if we had that attitude more when we tithe, it would make a big difference. Verse 31 now. If a man wants to redeem any of his tithes, he shall add one-fifth to it. Again, this is buying back from the priesthood, not borrowing from it while it's in our hands. Verse 32, and concerning the tithe of the herd or the flock of whatever passes under the rod, the tenth one shall be holy to the Lord. So this is where the basis of tithing in Israel became the law. The first tenth belongs to God. We do not give it. I know sometimes our language gets really casual and we can slip out of our mouth. We do not give tithe to God. We owe it to him. It is paid from our increase, the value that we add and extract from God's creation. The first tenth belongs to him. So if you and I had oak trees growing in our backyard, and we planted them at the same time from the same set of acorns from the same tree, and they were roughly the same size and shape and quality after about 20 years or so, and both of us wanted to cut them down and make money off of them, I would carve up that tree into firewood, use some of it and sell some of it, but I would have to recognize I'm gathering an increase. I'm adding value to this oak tree by turning it into firewood and selling it. What I sell it for, I need to pay tithe on. That's the increase. Or what I use as my own firewood, I'd have to set a value to it and recognize that I'm harvesting something from God's earth that belongs to him until I pay that first tenth to him. Now, you may have some incredible carpentry skills. You cut down the same oak tree in your backyard. Both of those trees at that point are worth about the same. But instead of carving it into firewood and burning it or selling it as firewood, you turn it into a series of great, beautiful dining room furniture. You know, tables and chairs and a buffet, and you sell them for like 10 or 15, 20 times more than what I could sell the firewood for. Now you owe tithe on what you sold that for. Same level of tree and value before we added to it. My adding was brute force and elbow grease. Yours was the skill of a carpenter that you had been taught over the years. And applying those skills, as both of us did, we had a different increase. Different level of increase, but we pay the same tenth. It's 10% across the board, not like a progressive income tax. So what the value you added to yours is much greater. You would pay more in a total dollar amount as tithe. Or maybe what you could do is take one of those dining room sets and give that to the priesthood, because that's what was done in ancient times. It's still done to this day. I still get a lot of squash and zucchini in August every year. And I usually tell them, you know what, I don't really care so much for squash or zucchini. Why don't you go to the store, find a dollar amount for what this is being sold for, take a tenth of that and send that in with your offering or your tithe money to the home office. That would be a much better use of that than giving me zucchini that's going to rot on my half wall. And every winter I have to throw them off into the woods. So I think my wife tries to make things like zucchini bread and others, and as long as there's sugar in it, I guess I can eat it, but less so anymore. In either case, that first tenth of the increase, the value we add while extracting from God's earth, we owe to God. And in many ways, this is much easier to do today than it was done in that agrarian economy of ancient Israel. Because, again, most of us that get a check, it's a weekly or a biweekly or a monthly check from a job, it's easy to take that dollar amount and tithe on that dollar amount. But there's an attitude that we have to have in respect of paying that tithe. Let's go to James chapter 4 here. James chapter 4. This is not expressly describing tithing, but there's a mindset that James is identifying here that we have to be careful of because it hinders our ability to understand and appreciate the concept or the privilege we have of tithing. By the way, if you want a title for your notes, this is entitled The Privilege of Tithing. The Privilege of Tithing. James 4, let's read verses 13 through 16. He says, is any among you, that's James 4, I'm in James 5. James 4, verse 13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell, and make a profit. This is kind of the, we have such freedom and such opportunity that God has given us in blessing our country the way he has in the world today, that there's all kinds of opportunity for us to grow in wealth. And we can develop this mindset that where we think we're directing all of this, where we think this is all us, it's all ours, and everything that we get from it is ours alone. Verse 14, whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a time and then vanishes away. Very few people think when their bank account has got millions in it and when their house is paid off and when they've got three or four cars and all kinds of toys in their house, full refrigerator. Very few people think about the fact that they're going to die. But all of us are one breath, one heartbeat away from ending this life. At that point, what is any of this going to do for us? You know, the parable that Christ gave about the guy who built barns, he had more and more wealth, so he tore down his old barns. They were too small, so he could build more barns and stuff even more of his wealth away. And then he says at the end, he said, what good is that? I mean, what is it going to do for you when you're dead and gone? Very few people have in mind the fact that they're going to die, that this life is temporary, and the stuff that we build in this age is temporary, and it's all going to go away. It's going to go back to where it came from. We can't put permanent, eternal value on something like that. And God is trying to help all of us understand where that eternal value is. Tithing is a way of helping us understand that we are using what God gives us here to actually develop true eternal value that will exist long before our bodies go back to the earth. Let me read verse 14 again, and then we'll read into down to verse 16. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow, for what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance, all such boasting is evil. Well, what leads to that boasting is this mindset where people who do this kind of thing in their business, in their job, and whatever they buy or purchase or hoard together in this age, and I'm not saying that's wrong by any means. It's wrong outside of this mindset, which is described in verse 15. If the Lord wills. See, tithers know this right up front. With all their wealth and their increase, they acknowledge right up front that I have to do what the Lord wills. I have to be involved in his plan. I have to take and use everything he's given me in this age, every breath, every pump of blood, every bit of wealth, by the will of God, not my own ideas. What are his passions? What is his reasoning in this? How is my conscience working like his is? I mean, what do I want with this life? And is that aligned with what God wants for me and others in this life? Tithing establishes that right up front. It establishes a very clear understanding of what our wealth is, temporary in nature, and all belonging to God, no matter how hard we work for it. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. This is the mindset of the tither, and it's not the mindset of anyone who does not acknowledge God's command to tithe. Though all things belong to God, he allows us to work with his earth. To responsibly extract its food, its materials, its ores, its woods, or anything else to work with the things that others have extracted as well, to buy those things, to sell them, distribute and trade, so that we can prosper and do well in this age. He wants that for us. But he has conditions. And the biggest condition right up front is pay him his tithe. It belongs to him. For those who work, this is calculated again with each paycheck. For others in business for themselves, it includes all profit from items sold or services rendered after expenses. For them, it can be much more difficult to understand how to do this. But the ministry can help you with that as well, to understand what those expenses are and how they should be paid. Many struggle with that, and not for wrong, selfish reasons. It's just sometimes difficult depending on your business. Again, if you were a farmer, you probably wouldn't be able to pay much tithe until after the harvest. So that's usually waiting for, you know, August, September, October before you would have a tithe to pay. If you were in the kind of business, though, like maybe you're a barber, just taking it out of the, and you cut hair, and you have pretty consistent customers every week, and they pay you with each haircut, then at the end of every week or every 2 weeks, you can pay that tithe. It's a lot more easy to figure out your profit relative to your expenses and do that. But there's a way of doing that with every profession on the planet, and we need to recognize that. And the ministry can help you figure that out if you have a difficulty with that. I was just helping somebody who had not paid tithe on the interest in their bank accounts for 20 years. Were never told they should do that. Interest on your bank account, and not only does the government take their share of that, but that is an increase. If you invest money and at a certain level, and maybe you have skill in investment, or maybe you're investing in something that you're even a part of, and you add to that, you increase your money as a result of that, that's an increase. And we need to tithe off of that. Now, unless you're very independently wealthy, that's usually a very small amount. It is for us. Every year, or we try to do it, I think, monthly. When we get a bank statement back, we kind of try to understand that. And the church has also made a decision because of, I think that the average tax rate in the U.S. today is 37%. In some countries like Norway, it's like 57%. The government extracts 57% of the money they make before they even see it. So the paycheck that comes to them, what they're able to spend on and save and do whatever else, 57% is taken from that before they even see it. It's the same thing with most of us here in the U.S. It's just not as a higher level, but it continues to grow. And if you add to that real estate taxes, sales taxes, and so on, the amount of money that we have to tithe off of is getting more and more difficult, not only to determine, but it's in some cases, depending on how much money people make, is putting them in poverty. I think the church made a decision years ago. I think HWA made this decision towards the end of his life, but also the United Church of God has also made this decision that if you can tithe off of the net of your wages versus the gross. You can still do the gross. Again, you can't outgive God, so whichever you choose to do, that's the church's wisdom, I think, in this age. It's helping us to understand how to apply that. But you can tithe off the gross or the net. However, if you tithe off the net, you have to determine what that net is and what led to that. It's not just taxes. For instance, if you have a 401k, money is extracted before it is taxed and put in an account that is for you. You can tithe off of that when it happens, although it's very difficult to do. The interest on that account is also going to grow over time. The fact that you can't touch that 401k money until you're later in life anyway, 57 and a half, I think is the age. They may have changed that, but in most cases it's not going to happen until you're retiring. But you can pay tithe off it as you extract it. So as you're actually using that money, as you actually have that wealth and money in your hand to use, that's when you would pay tithe off it. But again, the ministry can help us work through all those subtleties. It's getting more and more convoluted in our day and age, not because of the paycheck issue, but largely because of the government taking their share. It's getting harder and harder. Again, for most who work, this is pretty easy to calculate. It's just when you move into retirement or you have your own business, it's a little more difficult. Giving increasing tax rates More and more of what our work earns is taken from us before we even see it. Decades ago, the church decided to allow members to choose whether to tithe on the gross or the net, but it remains one of the UCG's fundamental beliefs. I'm not sure which number it is, but one of the 20 core beliefs talks about tithing. I think it's like 18 or 19 of the 20. Here's what it says, quote, "We believe in tithing as a way of honoring God with our substance and as a means of serving him in the preaching of the gospel, the care of the church, attending the festivals, and helping the needy." I'm referring to all principles of tithing there. Let's go back to Malachi here, Malachi chapter 3. So a principle we need to understand, when we recognize that the tithe, that first tenth, belongs to God, if we're not doing it, if we're not paying him that first tenth, what happens? Malachi 3, verses 8 through 10. Malachi is an interesting book. I really want to do a more thorough study on it. There's about 12 or 13 cases throughout where God says, you've done this, or you've failed to do this, and it has done that to me. And then their response, Israel's response, the priesthood's response is, how have we done that? And there's like 12 or 13 different things that are mentioned. One of them here is tithing. In chapter 2, it's talking about marriage. Things that they have made their own judgments and decisions on, but have ignored God in the process. He talks about that tithing in that context here. Malachi 3, verse 8. "Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, in what way have we robbed you in tithes and offerings?" If we're not tithing, if we're not giving God his tenth, we are stealing from him. That's what this says very clearly. If you aren't tithing, you're stealing from God. If you're not paying a tenth on your increase that you're making in this age, you're stealing from God. Verse 9, "You are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation has robbed me. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and try me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it." The blessing here, we recognize, it's not just wealth, prosperity, peace of mind in that respect. It's the peace of mind that comes from knowing God is our God and that we are his children, and that he's providing for us and developing us in his very nature and character. That is a spiritual blessing that there is no physical hold for. You can't put that in any physical bank. I mean, you can't stuff that under your mattress. As you grow in the very nature and character of God, there's no price you can put on that. And that's a blessing we receive from acknowledging God's will and living in accordance with his plan for humanity. To deny God's claim on our increase is stealing from God. Such an action disregards God's dominion over his creation and separates us from his purpose. That's a big curse. Refusal to tithe is open disregard for God's dominion, his work, and his plan for creation. Look at Nehemiah chapter 10 here. Nehemiah chapter 10, we'll read verses 35 through 39. Nehemiah chapter 10, and we'll begin reading in verse 35. It's also talking here about offerings and bringing the first fruits and so on, but towards the end it mentions tithing. The same principle applies. Nehemiah 10, verse 35. "And we made ordinances to bring the first fruits of our ground and the first fruits of all the fruit trees year by year to the house of the Lord, to bring the firstborn of our sons and our cattle, as is written in the law, and the firstborn of our herds and flocks to the house of our God, to the priests who minister to the house of our God." This is more a reference to what happened in ancient Israel when God took the firstborn of the Egyptians as well as the animals. In this case, in the book of Exodus, it's very clear that because of that, that all of Israel owed their firstborn to him, of their flocks and of their children. Now, obviously, they didn't sacrifice their children, but they brought an in-kind value of offering and payment for the child. But the firstborn, whatever broke the womb, was owed to God. Verse 37, to bring the first fruits of our dough, the offerings, the fruit from all kinds of trees, the new wine and oil, to the priests, to the storerooms of the house of our God, and to bring the tithes of our land to the Levites, for the Levites should receive the tithes in all our farming communities. It's a basic principle. Those who are doing God's work receive his tithe. So it's incumbent upon every tither to recognize that the priests that they are giving God's tithe to are doing the work of God. Verse 38, and the priest, the descendant of Aaron, shall be with the Levites, then the Levites receive tithes, and the Levites shall bring up a tenth of the tithes to the house of our God, to the rooms or the storehouse. The Levites themselves were required to give their tenth of what they received back to God. I should say pay, not give, pay. Verse 39, for the children of Israel and the children of Levi shall bring the offering of the grain, of the new wine and the oil to the storerooms where the articles of the sanctuary are, where the priests who minister and the gatekeepers and the singers are, and we will not neglect the house of our God. Failing to tithe is neglecting the house of God, neglecting his plan and purpose, neglecting those who are doing his work as he instructed them to do. But when we embrace that the principle, the privilege of tithing, it is a great blessing. All of God's laws are for our good. He does not need our tithes, brethren. He owns everything anyway. What he really wants for us is to receive his blessing as his children. He wants us to be involved in his work, his design for creation, his purpose of growing his family. In John 8 and verse 39, Christ talks about this. He says, a spiritually converted mind will do the works of Abraham. And if you're following Jesus Christ, you will do the works of Abraham. And what did he do? He brought tithes to God's priesthood. In Matthew 23:23, we see this affirmation from Christ again. Let's go there. It's a very short verse, but it's very clear what we're supposed to do. Matthew 23 and verse 23. Here he's mentioning concept of the weightier matters of the law, but by no means of that when we acknowledge the weightier matters of the law, does that mean that the less weighty matters of the law are less important? He says we should do one and not leave the other undone. Matthew 23:23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint, anise, and cumin. These are small seeds, herb seeds. And have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith. These you ought to have done, justice, mercy, and faith, without leaving the others undone, tithing on those small seeds. Tithing, a tenth is owed at both levels, everything that we do. But on the spiritual level, we also owe God an understanding of what it means to live by his law, justly, and by his love and mercy, and also by trusting in him and faith toward him. This is Christ's affirmation that tithing remains a current obligation for New Testament repentant believers. Again, to whom do we pay God's tithe? We've touched on this a number of times. Let's look at this in a little bit more detail. Numbers 18. Numbers chapter 18, we'll read verses 21 through 26. Numbers 18 and verse 21. Behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tithes in Israel as an inheritance in return for the work which they perform, the work of the tabernacle of meeting. There's a contingent within some of the Church of God, mostly the outlying independent groups, that we should not be paying the ministry. Well, nothing could be further from the case in as the Bible describes it. There was a time when Paul and Barnabas and others would not take a wage, worked rather by their hands, working with the Gentiles rather than whip an ancient concept of tithing on them, but they may have balked that. Give them time to understand that and then reap the blessing of it. But he confirms that. We'll read what Paul said about that as well. Verse 22. After the children of Israel shall not come near the children of Israel shall not come near the tabernacle of meeting, lest they bear sin and die. But the Levites shall perform the work of the tabernacle of meeting, and they shall bear their iniquity. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations, that among the children of Israel they shall have no inheritance. This is a reference to the Levites. For the tithes of the children of Israel, which they offer up as a heave offering to the Lord, I have given to the Levites as an inheritance. Therefore I have said to them, among the children of Israel, they shall have no inheritance. That tithe, God has determined, is the Levites' possession to do the work of God, to sustain themselves and their families, but also to do the work of God. And again, it's incumbent upon the tither, especially in this day and age, to recognize what the work of God is. The recipients of God's tithe in the new covenant remain those who serve God's house. Again, formerly this was the priesthood of Melchizedek, transferred to the Levites, but now it goes to Melchizedek. Let me just give you a couple of references here, describing what the work of God is in this respect. Number one, preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God as accurately and as completely as is possible. We see that in Matthew 28:18-20. Matthew 28:18-20, the commission given to the apostles that the church supports. Mark 16:15 as well. Mark 16:15. We also see this is what Christ did. Mark 1 and verse 1, also in verses 14 and 50 of Mark 1, 14 and 15. He preached the gospel of the coming kingdom of God and taught his disciples to do the same. The second aspect of that, obviously, is preparing God's people, the work of the tabernacle of meeting. We see this in John 21:15-17. John 21:15-17, where Peter is explained by Christ that if you love me, you know, take care of my flock, feed my sheep, feed my lambs, attend my flock. That is a commission given to the apostles and the priesthood, prepare God's people. In 1 Peter 2:9, Peter comments on that. I won't go there, though. 1 Peter 2:9. Also in Revelation 17:7, this reference to the church being the elect, the called, the bride of Christ. We are like best men working with her to prepare her for the time she will be given in marriage to Jesus Christ at his return. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 9 here and read that. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. We'll read verses 7 through 14. 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 7. Whoever goes to war at his own expense. Again, if you're taking on a mission to do something, especially if there's no clear understanding of a reward at the end, or having that reward in your hands to fund your war, you can't do that. Wars are usually financed in advance of the work being done. Who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its fruit? Who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk of the flock? Do I say these things as a mere man, or does not the law say the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the ox while it treads out the grain. Is it oxen God is concerned about? No, but there's a principle there that we need to all understand with respect to how the work is done in the church of God. Verse 10, or does he say it altogether for our sakes? For our sake, no doubt, this is written, that he who plows should plow in hope, and he who threshes in hope should be partaker of his hope. If we have sown spiritual things for you, is it a great thing if we reap your material things? Verse 12, if others are partakers of this right over you, are we not even more? Nevertheless, we have not used this right, he calls it a right, but endure all things lest we hinder the gospel of Christ. Verse 13, do you not know that those who minister the holy things eat of the things of the temple, and those who serve at the altar partake of the offering of the altar? Even so, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should live from the gospel. The church is obviously to support the work of God's ministry for God's work of preaching the gospel and preparing his people. And that's the basics on tithing. And we use first tithe mostly to explain that and help us to understand why it is such a privilege. Let's just touch on second and third tithe here before we close. Deuteronomy 14, we'll read first verses 22 through 27. Deuteronomy 14, verse 22, and then we'll read the end of that chapter, 28, 29. God's holy days picture his plan for the salvation of mankind. He expects us to save and prepare for them so that we can celebrate them in a manner befitting their design and their meaning. We can't just chintz at it. He wants to give us a tenth of our annual income to spend in 1 week at the Feast of Tabernacles so we can celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles in a way, in a manner fitting the celebration God designed it to be. This is Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain and your new wine and of your oil, the firstborn of your herds and flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. This is not being paid to the priesthood here. This is something that we're consuming. And when are we doing it? Before the Lord our God in the place where he chooses. This is a reference to the Feast of Tabernacles specifically, and generally to all the times that we come before him in his temple, as his temple. And we're supposed to eat of these things that we have set aside. This is talking about a different tithe, not first tithe. Verse 24, but if the journey is too long for you that you are not able to carry the tithe, or the place where the Lord your God chooses to put his name is too far from you, when the Lord your God has blessed you, then you shall exchange it for money, take the money in your hand, and go to the place which the Lord your God chooses. And you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep or whatever wine or similar drink or whatever your heart desires. You shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. You shall not forsake the Levite who is within your gates, for he has no part or inheritance with you. So even though the Levite receives first tithe as a means of supporting themselves for that period of time, they are also required to set aside a tenth for the celebration, their celebration as well, of those holy days. We are also supposed to keep them in mind because they will not have as much money as most of us would have. So God expects us to save and prepare for his holy days, and he instructs us to do that. He states that it is his responsibility to care for us, but we need to acknowledge that responsibility. He expands on that. That's second tithe. All the same principles of first tithe apply, but it's specific now to us spending it to celebrate his holy days in the manner he designed them to be celebrated. Now verses 28 and 29 talk about third tithe, which is paid every third year. It says here, 28, at the end of every third year, you shall bring out the tithe of your produce of that year and store it up within your gates. This is another recognition. It's not first tithe. It's not second tithe. That's saved all the time. This is only once every third year. And the Levite, verse 29, because he has no portion or inheritance with you, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who are within your gates may come and eat and be satisfied, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. In this case, that third tithe has been set aside but kept in the household and used to support the Levite, the fatherless, and the widow in the community, bring them in, teach, feed them, give them what they need, provide for them within the community itself. Today, third tithe, as the church has acknowledged the high tax rates, and in fact, many of those tax rates include things like Social Security, welfare, and other things that provide for the weak, the indigent, the elderly, the fatherless within our society. The church has acknowledged that paying third tithe is probably already done, at least civilly, through the taxes that we already pay. We do encourage people to set aside money, set aside funds in this manner within the community to take care of the widows, the orphans, the Levite, and so on, and use that money, that third tithe, not first tithe, not second, second with respect to the holy days, but a third tithe on a more regular basis. And it's a tenth every third year, so it's not a tenth constantly. God states that, listen, I'll just give you this reference in Proverbs 19 and verse 17. God states that his responsibility is to take care of the fathers and widows. So when we decide to involve ourselves in what his work is, we involve ourselves with him. When we involve ourselves in doing the same thing that he does, we again partner with him in his work. And he states here in Deuteronomy 14, and also in Proverbs 19:17, that he welcomes that involvement and that he is indebted to us for doing so. Brethren, tithing is a universal law. It is designed by God to be an acknowledgement of his dominion over all things created, seen and unseen, and a faithful confirmation on our part of our desire to be involved in his purpose for his creation. For those whose minds have been opened by God, tithing is an obligation. It's not an option. It is not given, it is paid. It is the duty of God's ministry to teach his people to pay God his tithe, but it is the responsibility of his people to pay and to faithfully obey that command. The ministry is in no way enforcing of this. The ministry home office does not police this. I mean, we don't send notes to people who miss a tithe payment. I do not check on your tithe payments. That's completely between you and God. And the ministry is supposed to be servants, not policemen. So that's just not done. But those who willingly and enthusiastically tithe are truly blessed beyond measure. In tithing, God has blessed us with the perfect financial system for providing for his work, celebrating his festivals, and caring for the poor. So let's be diligent to pay God his tithe and reap his great blessings.